Okay, folks. Well, good morning, everyone. This has certainly been one of those weeks in Washington that makes health reform seem tame by comparison. I didn't say easy, but just tame. We thought we'd try a more intimate setting this time up here in the Kaiser space, as some of you know, it is on the ninth floor rather than the big conference center downstairs, just because we thought it might be more conducive to an informal dialogue, which is really our goal, thanks very much, in these settings. Also, as I think all of you know, we built this building some years ago in part to let nonprofits use the conference center and broadcast studio downstairs, and mostly those are small nonprofits and broke nonprofits, though I don't know who's not a broke nonprofit this year. But today, the Pew Charitable Trust is borrowing the conference center downstairs. Apparently, they have big money, but just small facilities. It's so that's why we're upstairs today, for both of those reasons. It's a personal pleasure for me to have Senator Grassley here today, who's been such an important leader in health and will play a decisive role in deciding the fate of health reform this time around. I'm very happy to have him here today, as I know our partners are. We're going to have a schedule of all the future Newsmaker breakfasts out to you soon, but there is one date you may want to note, which is that Nancy Ann DeParle will be here on April 14th, and I know that's one you'll be interested in. So you might want to just jot that one down. At our first Newsmaker breakfast, Senator Baucus talked about the close working relationship he has with Senator Grassley. He talked about how closely their staffs work together and said that it was his aspiration that the two senators come together on health reform. And we all know that crossing the aisle on health reform and paying for health reform are really tough challenges, so perhaps this morning we'll get an early sense of what the possibilities for that may be. That's all from me this morning. This is not about us. This is all about hearing from Senator Grassley. So with that, I'll turn it over to my partner for just some brief remarks, and then to Ron for to introduce the senator, and we're off and running.
Great. Thank you. I'm Dan Danner with NFIB. It's a great pleasure for me to be here today, and I'm particularly excited about our speaker this morning because I know he understands the significance and importance of small business. Certainly a great factor in his state. And he also understands the challenges that small businesses face trying to find and purchase health care. And it really does start with cost and affordability, I think, for small businesses. Small businesses definitely want a solution. And we believe very strongly that this needs to be a bipartisan solution. So we very much look forward to working with a senator and trying to find a healthcare solution that works for America's job creators. It's a great pleasure for me to be here.
Thank you. Thanks, Dan. Thanks, Drew. I have the great pleasure to introduce our guest of honor, Senator Chuck Grassley. All of us who care about trying to achieve healthcare reform want to do it on a bipartisan basis. And to do it on a bipartisan basis, it goes through Senator Grassley's door. And so we're delighted to have the senator speak to us here today. As you know, he's the ranking minority member of the all-important Senate Finance Committee that has primary jurisdiction over health care. He's on the Senate Budget Committee. He works very closely with his colleague, Senator Baucus. So I think the opportunities for doing something on a bipartisan basis appear reasonably promising. In introducing him, I thought I'd mention three things that are not usually said about the senator. One is he loves town hall settings, so he loves good give and take, and I think this forum will be right down his alley. Another thing that's least known, perhaps, about the senator is he's a real technological renaissance person. The last time we were together, he brought one of his staff people, had a camera so that he could be on YouTube. He likes to Twitter. He loves to be on, He gets on Facebook and MySpace. I had the, if you don't mind, I had the nerve to say, you're cool. Lastly, we learned something new about the senator, if you don't mind, a double entendre. He has a real yen for Japanese culture. So it is with great delight that we bring to you Senator Chuck Grassley.
I appreciate this opportunity to be with you, and particularly to thank all the organizations involved in bringing you folks together to help us communicate with the American people an issue that needs a lot of discussion at the grassroots level if we're going to get things done. So you folks are helping us do our job of representative government. We're one half of that. Our constituents are the other half of that. It takes dialogue to accomplish that, and the facility of the media plus the organizations sponsoring this are very important in that process, because this is not something that's going to get by the American people. The American people are very concerned about health care delivery, most importantly, the high cost of health care, probably reflected more in the high cost of insurance than with anybody else or in any other way. And so they're going to be very observant. But it's a very complicated issue, and it's one that not only does it need a general discussion, but there's subsets of it that need a great deal of understanding. Before I get to what I would call opening remarks, let me say something about a policy in another department of government that I think is counterproductive to what we're trying to do of bringing preventive medicine to the practice of medicine in the United States. And that's the policy of the Attorney General, not enforcing marijuana laws. If you see the high cost of medicine that comes from drug abuse and what it drives up, not enforcing the marijuana laws, which are a gateway to other hard drugs, and particularly if you see the methamphetamine problems and the health problems that are connected with methamphetamine, this Attorney General is not doing health care reform any good, particularly the bit about getting health care costs down. And so the first rule of medicine, first do no harm, is being violated by the Attorney General with his decision. As I go into this issue of health care reform, I think the stage has been set by Senator Baucus, and I'm somewhat repetitive, but thank him for the close working relationship that we've had for 8 years, now going on the ninth year. Two-thirds of that time I was chairman, one-third he's chairman. Before it's all said, it'll be one-third I'll be chairman, he'll be two-thirds chairman, the way the numbers work out. But it doesn't make much difference, because wherever you come from in working with him, it seems to me that in most cases we're able to get bipartisan things done. And just in case you might wonder, so far this year, is that really bipartisanship? Some legislation that's already passed. I think don't judge Grassley-Baucus relationship by a couple things that have passed in a partisan way that would normally, coming out of our committee, be more partisan, because I think there's been a lot of things forced on Senator Baucus by leadership that he isn't comfortable with, but some things that had to move quickly and make it appear that may be a shattered relationship. It's not. In fact, Tuesday we met for the fourth time this year on the agenda of this year's work. We're going to meet at 4:30 again. Normally we don't have Thursday meetings, but we're going to meet again on today for another small aspect of our working together. So this working relationship is going to help us get health care reform through, because I don't think it's one that the usual bipartisan tool is going to fit into. If you understand the Byrd rules and if you understand reconciliation, you might think, well, if you can't get a bipartisan agreement, the Democrats can get it anyway. But considering Byrd rule, it's going to be a very difficult thing for them to do. But I think the overriding issue, and I'll bet you Senator Baucus gave you this figure. He wants a bill to pass by 75 to 80 votes. That dictates bipartisanship. I think he feels comfortable with it, and obviously I feel comfortable with it. And one reason why I think it's possible is because there might be divisions within the Republican Party on certain aspects of health care reform. But honestly, to this point, I have not had one Republican of the 41 tell me that we should not be doing health care reform. So I'm very positive about it. I'm somewhat cautious when I come to a meeting like this and everything I say is going to be, well, maybe not everything. Maybe I hope everything would be reported. not everything's going to be reported, and maybe I'll be lucky some things won't be reported. But I'm cautious about coming here because we are not so far down the road that some things that are said just wrong could upset the apple cart. And it's an apple cart that maybe not between Baucus and me could be upset, but other people of both political parties could upset the process. And I want to be very cautious in how I answer some of your questions, and maybe some of your questions I won't answer for that reason. But understand our working relationship is not just Baucus Grassley. I think over a period of 8 years, you could consider the staff of finance, yes, divided between Republican and Democrat, but as one staff, a pretty close working relationship, a pretty good understanding of what of where other people are coming from, most importantly, an understanding of what it takes to get a bipartisan agreement. And whereas Baucus and I may talk regularly, but for short periods of time, these folks are dealing all the time. So I'm positive that we can get health care reform done. I want to emphasize that politically, in order to have a bipartisan agreement, it's got to be done through regular order and not reconciliation. I think our goal has to be to bring costs under control. I think one of the principles that was agreed to by both the president and most people in Congress is that if you got health insurance that you like right now, you ought to be able to keep that. One of the controversial things that will come up will affect that. In other words, let me just speculate. There's a private option, or there's a public option plan out there. Okay, Lewin says you have a public option plan. You know, the government is not a fair competitor. It can dictate. I mean, it can drive, let's put it that way. And Lewin says that, you know, after a period of time, 118 million people are going to opt out. And it's particularly in small business, maybe, that may be an issue. So you kind of get to a point, well, if 118 million people out of X number of people that have health insurance now opt out, then, you know, what's left drives up the cost so much that eventually I think it's a step towards single payer. And even the president of the United States has said that he's not out to have a single payer. But, you know, progress kind of can go in that direction. It's something that could happen slowly, like the analogy of a frog put in a boiling water jumps out and lives. But you put a frog in cold water, heat it up to a boil, and he will die. So those that want to preserve, you know, the option of a John Deere worker maintaining their insurance and having a government as a competitor, pretty soon there might not be John Deere insurance, as an example. And John Deere is a major industry in my state, and that's why I use them as an example. I think another principle that everybody wants to maintain, but I think you got to understand that it's pretty easy when the government's driving something to get in the way, and that's maintaining the doctor-patient relationship. And without going into detail, I would refer you to a short speech that I gave yesterday on the floor of the Senate, where I think that some things of health care reform could take us in the direction of interference in doctor-patient relationship. It's not a long speech, probably just 5 or 6 minutes, so I won't go into detail on that. I think we also have been led to believe by spokesmen for the administration, maybe even some people in Congress, that it's necessary to do health care right now because of the situation of the economy. And maybe it's more, can you do this in the economy at the same time? The answer is yes, you can, so I'm not finding fault with people that are promoting this at the same time we're trying to get out of a recession. But I think people are led to believe that this is something that's going to help us with the short-term economic problems. Obviously, it's not. It could help us and hopefully will help us with long-term budget problems. But it in and of itself is not a fix on the tremendous entitlement problems that we have before us. It's a partial help towards the entitlement problems, but it's not a total help. I think that that there's probably a lot of other things I should say, but I'll stop there and let you folks set the agenda. And when I say let you set the agenda, that's exactly what I say at my 99 town meetings that I have in each of the 99 counties of Iowa every year for 28 years, 24 so far this year. So you set the agenda.
The senator asked me to moderate, understanding that he can take over whenever he chooses to do that. I just ask you to identify yourselves, not because we don't know who you are, but for the webcast. And the one thing I do want to do, the one prerogative, is just give Karen Tumulty the first question, only because of her wonderful piece in about her brother, which we all so much enjoyed. So, and you raised your hand anyway.
Okay. Well, Senator, just on this Karen Tumulty from Time Magazine, just on this last point that you made, that it's not a short-term fix for the economy, does this mean that you don't necessarily think it has to actually get done this year? Because the other argument for doing health care reform this year is that if you wait, you're going to end up repeating what happened in 93.
I think if it isn't done this year, it won't be done for the next 4 years. So I think it needs to be done this year. Something just came to my mind unrelated to her question, but I think I made this clear in my comment about marijuana, first do no harm. I think it's counterproductive to our goals of preventive medicine, and if I didn't say that, that was the point that I was trying to make.
Okay, Wyatt?
Wyatt Andrews from CBS. Senator, thanks so much for doing this. Weren't you the one that asked the president the other day about the public option? That was your question.
Yes, I did.
It seemed to me that he kind of minimized that. The construct of his answer was essentially, we need this public option, I see, to keep the private payers honest. So, something to that effect. So I'm wondering what your thoughts were. Bluntly, do you trust that answer? And as a second part of the question, isn't there a value to a public plan if it creates a certain national minimum of coverage for everybody who gets into the system?
Can I? I want to answer all of your questions, so if I forget something, I'll start with the last thing because that's the easiest way for me to remember. First of all, remember, you can do it through the public option, yes, but don't forget the problems we had with supplemental insurance policies for Medicare during the 80s. We had 1,000 of them develop, and people were over-insuring, buying policies three or four times to cover one thing. So what we did is we set a pattern. They had to fit into 10 principles, or they had to emphasize 10 things, so we didn't have this duplication, so it wasn't a problem for the senior citizen. And we can do the same thing for private insurance. In fact, we do it for private insurance only through the states with all the mandates that we have. So we can do it. It would be preemption of state law. And if uniformity is what you want, we can legislate that without the private option and accomplish that. Now, go back. And the other one was about what the president exchanged with me. I think the president had to say what he had to say. And if it had been a Republican president, Republican president would have had to say it maybe shouldn't be an option, because here's where you are on this issue. I don't know what forum I heard this about. I was not there. But somebody brought up, does the plan have to have a private option? Well, there was somebody speaking either for the Republicans or like a Republican and said something like, well, if you have a public option in there, then it's no go. You know, you just can't have it. And then there was, I think, Mr. Stern over here from the union said, well, if you don't have a public option in it, it's a no-go for us. So the president's got to take a position that everything's on the table. And since I take a view that there's almost anything compromisable in public affairs, except probably the issue of abortion, I say, you know, I don't want to say that there's not something, but this is a very difficult issue to find a compromise is. Right now, I'd have to say I don't see a compromise, but I'm going to take the same approach the president takes because I want to see what's possible. And there were extremes. I know the prescription drug issue is about that big compared to this issue of overall health care reform, but there were litmus test issues there between Republicans and Democrats, between Bush on the one hand and, you know, let's say Senator Kennedy on the other hand. Senator Baucus and Bro and I and Senator Hatch, we compromised to get that done. And so I'm not going to say that there's some issue, some way this can be compromised, but right now I'm going to kind of take a purist position for my side, as the president took maybe not a really purist position, because I think he wanted to give me a little bit of leeway that he was considering what I said, but he's taking a purist position for his party now.
Marilyn, and if you're on the side, please just speak up again for the webcast.
You said earlier that if healthcare doesn't get done this year, it's not going to get done for the next 4 years. You could explain that a little bit more.
Yeah, because...
And is there a danger that the current distraction over the financial rescue plans and possibility of more money could actually delay it then?
Well, first of all, you got to think that you can adopt a policy and you can trigger a date down the road. But the obvious answer is, if it doesn't get done this year, why won't it get done? One word, elections. See? And the financial problems could have something to do with it. But, you know, some people that maybe want to move more slowly in this area than Senator Baucus and I do have brought that up and without saying that they really want to slow down health care reform. I think that's part of the motive. But they're saying the president's trying to do too much, you know, because we ought to concentrate on this recession issue. But maybe the president can only focus on one thing, but Congress can do more than one thing, and we're going to do more than one thing. And during World War II, we didn't fight just World War II. We passed the GI Bill. We passed ADC legislation, first welfare. You know, Congress legislated during World War II. We may have a war on recession, but we can also legislate in this very important area, and we will.
Let's go three on this side, and then we'll come back here. We'll go Marilyn Weber, Serafini, Julie, and Robert, and then we'll come back over on this side.
Senator Marilyn Serafini from the National Journal. Could you talk a little bit about financing? I've heard some Republicans say that they're very concerned about potentially not paying for this legislation. So first, how big a problem would it be if Democrats didn't completely offset this package, but also there seems to be some question about how you do it within the budget window. Can you have some flexibility to invest more upfront and have some of the savings later on? And how flexible should we be?
Well, first of all, I think a principle of I think all 41 Republicans, but I don't want to say absolutely 41, but I think it's a consensus among us that it's got to be paid for. And that partly is driven by what Democrats have done in the previous Congress of PAYGO. You know, it's our reminding them of a principle that they laid out, and they ought to live by the principle. In regard to costs, would you repeat one of your questions?
Yeah, it has to do with has to do with the budget window and how much flexibility should there be. There are many people who are saying, well, you know, we invest
up front. Yes. Well, I think that there may have to be some investment up front, so I don't want to preclude that there must be, but I think you've got to look at the document put out in January or December by CBO, that there's not a lot of savings there, and so I think you're going to have a lot of us questioning those investments to begin with. On the other hand, whenever you get a program started, there is some upfront cost.
You say that this absolutely needs to get done this year. Well, the one way to give it a real shot at getting done this year is to put it in reconciliation. Obviously, that takes away the biggest, you know, weapon of Republicans, the ability to filibuster and the ability to, you know, to force 60 votes. Is there any way that that would not be seen as the ultimate, you know, declaration of bad faith to have reconciliation
instruction? I'm not assuming bad faith, and I'm not assuming a reconciliation, because going back to November 13th and every time since then that we've had this kind of board of directors that includes the HELP committee plus our committee plus the budget committee, and Senator Baucus chairs those, I've had the occasion to bring it up, and every time I've gotten the same answer, that they expect to use regular order. So I'm taking them at their word, and I'm not going to raise questions about it. If I would speak about that being a possibility, then that's kind of showing that I don't have good faith in what Senator Baucus says, and I do think it's a good faith statement. I didn't say this at the time I said about, you can assume that maybe bipartisanship's broken down by the first two bills that were in our jurisdiction that passed. I said that I thought Senator Baucus was uncomfortable with that, and I think that everything he said about bipartisanship on this is the same thing I've been hearing him say since we first sat down in January of 2001 and decided to meet once a week to plan the agenda for the committee, and we've been doing that.
Are you confident that, he set out, both of you have set out this, what sounds like incredibly ambitious schedule to get a bill of this magnitude, you know, both not just out of committee but to the Senate floor. You think you can do that under regular order?
Yes,
I do.
Robert, you had your hand up. You still? No. Okay. Let's go down this side.
Drew Armstrong, Congressional Quarterly. You and a lot of other Republicans I've been speaking with have mentioned the preserving the doctor-patient relationship. And in the past, and sometimes when questioned about what that means, it can sometimes be a surrogate for not making cuts to certain providers when we talk about rejiggering the payment system or things like that. So what does not interfering with the doctor-patient relationship means? It can be a very broad term a lot of times used to defend.
Let's say that the crux of your question is not through the payment system. I think the extent to which we moved, and this is one of the principles I should have laid out that they were trying to accomplish here, and I didn't get to that point, but put down that a very important point for me, and hence answering your question at the same time, is moving from quantity, paying based on quantity, to quality, or performance measures, whatever you want to call it. It's got a lot of different names. And I think that that's the way, number one way. A second way would be to the present, we pay on quantity now. And in the process of paying on quantity, now this may be self-corrected by going from quantity to quality, but let's just suppose we stay on quantity. We have, through our payment system, we've upset the whole practice of medicine to such a point that we don't have very many primary care givers, primary care doctors, and that has driven up the cost of medicine itself, with emphasis upon specialists, and it has reduced the quality of delivery, particularly in rural areas, and it has, and we don't have very many practitioners as well wherever you are. So This analogy was given by one of the medical professional people that are members of Congress. We pay specialists four times what congressmen get paid. We pay primary practitioners, primary doctors, less than what we get paid. And so we have incentivized, since at least the Shaw study of the late 80s, shoved everything over here into everybody going into specialty. And you need some of that, but we've overdone it. And we've got to incentivize people to be family practice. It's a whole lot like in the 1960s when I was in the state legislature. We wondered why medical doctors were going to California to practice. Well, one was that we general practitioners were not considered a specialty, so they set up a family practice specialty. So we set up a family practice specialty. The other one was that we were educating doctors in Iowa, and all the professors there were saying, go to California. That's where you get the high money, see? So, you know, policy has consequences, and we've had consequences of overemphasizing specialists beyond the need to a point where the practice of medicine in the upper Midwest from Wisconsin to the, let's say, the Pacific Ocean, but obviously not including California, and from Kansas up to Canada, if we practice medicine in the rest of the country like we do there, we would save one-third of Medicare because, well, people are healthier. That's part of it. People don't overutilize is a big part of it. Doctors don't send you to the hospital at a drop of a hat, and more importantly, they don't send you to 25 specialists. Now, I don't know whether it's as bad as the doctors in Des Moines tell me, but they said go to Louisiana, and you can see Louisiana on the Dartmouth study how costly it is there, but they're sending people to 25 specialists compared to an average of 5 or 6 in Des Moines, Iowa. Now, maybe you'll have to go to the doctors of Iowa to get a justification for that. I'm quoting them, and I'm happy to quote them because I think when I see the Dartmouth study, I think they know what they're talking about.
Can I follow up on that? Or,
I didn't even answer your question.
I know.
You should have interrupted before I ate up all the time.
OMB Director Orzak, he pointed to that map and he said, this is where the biggest pot of money is. And, you know, one person's waste is another person's income, obviously. And you talk about how congressional policy has created all these specialists, and in a sense, you've created your own monster that you're going to have to deal with on the lobby side.
You understand it was based on a Harvard professor by the name of Shaw.
Well, but I guess you're going further north in the Ivy League now. So I'm wondering, now that this monster has been created and presumably any cuts there are going to be very poorly received, given that this is the biggest pool, if you believe what Orzak says, how do you try to break the back of that thing? If you really are honest about cost control and you look at the biggest pot of what I think everybody agrees is wasted money.
It's probably something you can do in an overall health care reform bill that we're talking about here at this meeting. But it's not something you could do if we don't get this bill passed and we got to pass a Medicare bill in November, you know, just to keep doctors from being cut. So it's got to be it's got to be kind of lost in the whole overall issue.
All right, next, by the way, my first job in health was on the Dartmouth study, but I won't tell you how long ago that was. Next question. Yeah.
Hannah Edney with Congress Daily. Senator Grassley, can you talk a little bit more specifically about paying for it? The president has suggested possibly limiting itemized deductions. Senator Baucus has talked about some way to tax health benefits. Do you like either of those or hate either of those or have your own ideas?
Okay. Well, the first one was when you move from quantity to quality, there's some savings there, probably big savings, and there's probably more of a equitable distribution of the Medicare dollar from parts of the country where there's overspending to countries where there are parts of the country where they're a little more careful. Now, you ask one of these questions that I'm probably not going to answer. but let me speak around it and maybe get myself into trouble, even if I try to be cautious. This is an 800-pound gorilla in the room. It's an issue that Senator Baucus has spoken out on, got some criticism. It's something that the president's, I shouldn't say maybe the president, but at least the White House had spoken out on and pulled back a little bit. So I'm going to be careful not to speak out about it, except it's something that's on the table, but not necessarily just as a revenue raiser. It's on the table because economists have studied the use of they've studied the use of, I'll say, higher-priced health plans and have come to the conclusion that they tend to bring about overutilization and expense that goes with overutilization, and that they are that is a contributing factor to the inflation of health health costs by maybe 2 or 3 percentage points. So if we do something in that area, it's also got something to do with savings as well as raising money. The extent to which it's a compromise of the president's position as well as mine and Wyden and Baucus, that if you got your health insurance now, you ought to be able to keep it. The extent to which you would cap something, it would be a compromise of that, but not any more of a compromise than the president's public option. If you're going to have 118 million crowd out and eventually you don't have private health insurance or it's too costly so you can't afford it, you know, people inadvertently are being denied what we promise them of keeping what you have. So it's something that we're going to have to move in cautiously. And quite frankly, unless there's a great big consensus to do that, what your question is about capping, I assume, and to raise money or for the other more important reason of taking inflation out of health insurance, it's not going to happen unless there's a great big consensus to get it done.
Hi, Senator. Steve Teske from BNA. Can you walk me through your timeline and Senator Baucus's timeline? If you're talking about having it in committee June or maybe July, you have...
If I misstated, I would like to have Mark and my staff join me in trying to answer it. But it's my understanding that that next week plus going into April at the subcommittee level, which is Senator Rockefeller, there's going to be hearings on certain aspects of it. And I think two or three of those are scheduled. And then probably three roundtables, which is we've been invited to do by the experience that Senator Kennedy has used roundtables in his help committee as being very helpful to getting consensus. Probably three roundtables during April and May. And also during this period of time, certain segments of it, of a plan worked out between Baucus and me within our jurisdiction, and I can't speak for the HELP committee, but certain segments of it being put out for discussion purposes, probably in tune with the dates of the roundtables on those certain subsets, and then getting to legislation in June with hopes of having it on the floor in July. Is that right?
They would like to have the markup in June and go through to the floor in June.
Oh, okay.
So that basically leaves you 2 months, I mean, with vacations and everything to get this done. And I'm just thinking in the past, just to doing like a very much simpler Medicare bill, it's taken you 6, 7, 8 months to, and this is like hugely complicated. Could you explain how you're going to do that?
Well, first of all, I hope you would agree that if we don't set an aggressive agenda, it's not going to get done this year. It's just our commitment to getting it done and the hard work that we're willing to put in, and probably only one other issue that's going to interfere with the work of the committee, and that would be possibly if there's an energy bill out of energy, we may have a tax component to that, but energy legislation within our committee tends to be very bipartisan and almost non-controversial. So I think you're talking about the ability of Senator Baucus and I to keep our attention on it, on this one issue, as well as our staff in the health areas of both sides of the aisle would not be working on health issues in conjunction with this until you get to November, December, and we don't get this done, and we got to pass something just on Medicare updates.
Robert.
Senator, have you expressed any position on the idea of requiring most employers to contribute to the cost of coverage for their workers?
No, I have not, and that's one that I haven't thought out thoroughly, so I can't give you an opinion. Except I can add to it, though, things that I have to consider. I have to consider how Massachusetts is working out and the problems that they have, and I think those issues in Massachusetts or the inability of California to move ahead with a plan that presumably at one time there was a bipartisan consensus between the governors and Democrats in the legislature to move forward on, and then even the Democrats in the legislature backed off of it. And I assume that it had something more than just the budget problems of the state of California that was basic for that. We got lessons to learn from our laboratories of the states in this regard.
Let's go to Texas and then to Noam.
Senator Grassley, I'm Jim Landers of the Dallas Morning News. I wanted to go back to what you were saying about a public insurance option. I didn't really get what you were trying to say.
Yeah.
President's got a position where he says, well, you know, keep the option open. You're keeping the option open or just closing it down?
Let me ask you, did I confuse you in my opening remarks or did I confuse you in the answer to his question?
Answer to his question.
Okay. There was two answers to his question. One was the issue itself, and the other one was the approaching of it by the two political parties or by the two extremes. And I think that the easiest way to answer the latter is that at this point, everything's on the table. And you don't negotiate if everything's not on the table, even if there's something that's on the table, that if it's on the table at the end, you don't have a deal, see? So everything's got to be on the table if you're negotiating in good faith. But then let me speak to the substance of it, because I think this is the most important aspect. The president says, I say, Baucus says, Wyden says, we want people to be able to keep the insurance that they have right now if they decide to keep it. Okay. You have a public option that people can buy into. Government is not a fair competitor. And so you have a government plan, and eventually it crowds out. Lewin says 118 million people. When you crowd out 118 million people, you want to have a private health insurance choice for people because we promised it to them. It becomes so expensive for the small pool that's left that eventually you end up with a single payer. And then that's contrary to the original promise of being able to keep what you want to. So if you want to keep the promise of people keeping what they have, you have to have a viable public or a private insurance industry, and you aren't going to have a viable private insurance industry if you have an unfair government competition. Is that clear?
Okay, so we're going to Noam, and then Lester had a question. We do have a hard ending at 9.
Senator, I want to follow up on Noam Levy with LA Times. I want to follow up with the questions that Drew was asking about utilization. If you're going to tackle the issue of overutilization in a place like Mississippi, doesn't that necessarily then mean that the federal government has to be in a position of saying to patients and doctors in, say, Jackson, Mississippi, you can't go to that extra specialist, or we're not going to pay for that extra specialist?
No. Because what we're saying, it's the government policy has driven doctors to and it's encouraged overutilization, it's encouraged abuse of the system, it's encouraged gaming of the system. And we want to take the gaming of the system out.
But how would you do that?
By rewarding people on quality instead of quantity.
Senator, I'm Lester Fader with The Nation. I want to pick up on the point you're making about this unfair competition with a public public option. As you know, in your state, Wellmark has over 50% of the market share in insurance, and the next closest competitor is about 12%. And I'm wondering if you can, I mean, if that situation is considered fair competition, if Wellmark could be considered an unfair competitor, and how, short of a public option that might shake up that kind of a breakdown of the insurance market, you'd come up with a regulatory scheme that allowed fair competition to take place.
Sure, just by striking the prohibition against selling insurance across state lines.
And you don't, and you're not worried that would precipitate a race to the bottom in terms of how they were structured, the insurers? Or you think you could put in place a national regulatory scheme?
Well, if you think it's necessary, as the question over here implied, that you had to have a public option in order to have some sort of uniformity or some sort of minimum coverage, we can legislate that minimum coverage. We preempted state law in the early 1990s on supplemental insurance to do exactly that.
Thank you.
Other questions? Let's see, who hasn't asked one yet? Yeah.
Senator, what do you think the political price would be to Republicans this year if there's opposition enough on your side of the aisle that this fails this year?
Well, that's not a problem, because I haven't had anybody tell me that they didn't want health care reform. And, you know, I've got people in my party that are not bashful tell me that I cooperate too much with the Democrats.
So in relationship to the goodwill that Republicans, you say, have this year, what do you see as the major stumbling points this year? Is it the substance of the policy? Is it the price tag that they'll have to face? Is it the distractions as...
I think the major difference between the two political parties is the extent to which we keep a market-based health insurance or we have a government-driven based health insurance.
And is there anything incremental that could be done this year that would address that wouldn't be considered comprehensive?
I think that if we do something incremental this year, you're never going to get comprehensive health care reform. Now, I'll back up a little bit from saying incrementalism is entirely out. You could have, as long as we adopt an overall health care reform, you could have a little bit of incrementalism through phasing in certain aspects of it or when you start it. Let me back up to your first point about Republicans being blamed. Why would Republicans be blamed if we don't have a health care insurance any more than the Democrats would be blamed? Can you tell me where you're coming from with a question like that? I mean, are you... okay. Well, then let me show you the good faith of the Republicans. Every Wednesday that we've been in session since the second week of January, we have had an hour-long meeting of everybody in the Republican caucus to be educated about this issue, express their views, and brought in experts to do it with an understanding that we have the very same job within our Republican caucus of educating people about the details of this, the same way that I said that a meeting like this is very useful to help educate the people at the grassroots about the subsets of this. Nobody needs to be educated about the need of health care reform or the 50,000 level, but we got to start educating people at the 10,000 level. Are you always provocative?
Always.
Okay. I guess
in Maryland,
you must have went to the University of Missouri School of Journalism.
She says she did. Oh. Yeah, Marilyn, last question. Then we'll see if the senator wants to make some final comments.
I need to dragging you back to the subset of the public plan, but... a lot of people are talking about public plan as an all-or-nothing proposition. And you have mentioned the word a few times today of compromise. Can you give us some idea of what compromise could potentially look like? Some people have talked about FEHBP, which doesn't actually have a public plan, but yet it's run by the government. It has some government say in there. I mean, what is a compromise?
I think you get back to the same answer I gave this gentleman over here. You set up certain minimums that every insurance policy has to have. And then the options are, who do you want to buy from in the private sector? Well, I think haven't I made clear that when you have 118 million crowd out under Lewin's study, you don't have eventually don't have any private health insurance. This is a deal breaker for Republicans if it's in, and it's a deal breaker for Democrats if it's not in. Is there a compromise in between? I don't see one today. There might be one. And if you're going to legislate in good faith, I should say negotiate in good faith, everything's on the table. But it's one of the most difficult things, and I don't see a compromise in that area. But I told you that only abortion is about the only issue I know of that's not compromisable.
Senator, would you like to make a final comment that might or might not have anything to do with the public plan?
Well, it's the same thing I would tell a radio station when I get on it on my weekly broadcast, that thank you for helping us communicate with our constituents. Representative government's a two-way street. I'm one half of that process. My constituents the other half. We have to have dialogue. Thank you for helping us have dialogue through this forum with our constituents in a very important issue, because the education of the American people at the grassroots are very essential to get this passed, and that's why I should have and didn't, but now I do compromise the president for having his health care forum 2 weeks ago, and I compromise him for having five around the country, of which he's going to have one in Des Moines on Monday.
Okay. Yeah. So thank you all for coming. Certainly thank the senator for coming, and as this develops, should you be interested, you're more than welcome to come back and do it again.
Well, there's nothing happened today that I wouldn't welcome an opportunity to come back.
Okay.